What new discoveries are waiting to be found in the heart of deep space? This is Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Western Worlds. I'm John Kissy, and I'm coming to you, as always, from the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration at the University of Western Ontario, London, Canada. What mysteries lie in the heart of deep space in the centre of galaxies? Since the widespread acceptance of the general and special theories of relativity, scientists have searched for confirmation of the theories through observation of the cosmos. Those observations have shown many unusual objects, some of which defy conventional explanation. This week we talk to Meg Urie, Israel Munson Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Yale University, specializing in extragalactic astronomy, galaxy structures, and high-energy astrophysics. We discuss her career and her most recent research into black hole formation and evolution, dark matter, and dark energy. So without any further delay, let's have a listen.
So thank you for talking to us today. Let's start off with a little bit of background. How did you get into astronomy? What was your first motivation or, you know, your first kind of bright light of this is what I want to do? Yeah, if you could just, you know, talk about your journey.
Sure. So I was kind of late to astronomy compared to a lot of people I know. I came in through physics. So I studied physics in college. I really liked it. And I was looking for a summer job, and I was lucky enough to get a summer internship at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, which is in Charlottesville, Virginia, and they have telescopes in West Virginia. And at the time, they were building the very large array in New Mexico. So I went to work for a guy who was like a young postdoc, you know, seemed old to me, but he was like a newbie. And he had done a survey of the sky in radio waves. And one of my jobs was to identify the optical counterpart of the radio sources. So I spent the summer learning about quasars, these very luminous supermassive black holes at the centers of galaxies, and learning about all sorts of stars and galaxies and stuff that I didn't know anything about. First of all, I thought it was a lot of fun, really, really interesting. And second of all, it was an amazement to me that people actually paid you to work on this, to discover things. So I came back from that totally fired up to do astrophysics.
Okay, so then you went on to your route of PhD.
So I applied to graduate school, and I should tell you that I was rejected from most of the ones I applied to. So, you know, things don't always go smoothly, right? Mm-hmm. But I ended up at Johns Hopkins University, which worked out really well for me. I ended up doing my thesis at the Goddard Space Flight Center, which is run by NASA. And I got into some projects in X-ray astronomy, which was pretty new at the time. The first X-ray, well, not the first, but the next generation of X-ray satellites was being launched in the late 1970s, right when I was starting graduate school. And so I did my thesis at Goddard, and then I did a postdoc at MIT, and then started the faculty track. Although I didn't work at a university at the beginning, I went to the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland, which runs the Hubble Space Telescope for NASA.
Yeah, it's, you know, strange that when people think about studying astronomy, they always think about like a professor track or a tenure track, and they don't think about that there are places like the Space Science Telescope Institute where you could have a master's and still be working on, you know, these kinds of awesome things. So kind of, I guess, for listeners, it's kind of a thing that you should try out different things.
Yeah, it's, you know, research is really different from what you learn in class. And so you may like or not like your classes, and that may have very little to do with whether you would enjoy doing research.
Okay, so let's kind of talk about what your current research topic is, black holes. So for people who don't really know what black holes are, maybe you could describe briefly what they are.
Yes, they're something that originally was predicted by Einstein's theory of general relativity. And I think at the time, people didn't really take them seriously. Like, it was just a consequence of his theory, and who knew if nature did that. But starting in the 1960s, people started to observe weird phenomena that were hard to explain. And essentially, they were seeing a tremendous amount of energy being generated in a small region of space. It was agreed that, for various reasons, that the energy was being generated by actual black holes, which are made when there's a tremendous amount of mass in a very small volume. So, you know, if you wanted to make a black hole out of the Earth, for example, you'd have to smush it down into a small volume the size of a sugar cube. So if you could make the Earth that small, it would be a black hole.
Okay, so they're certainly very powerful, and from what we know, they are at the center of every galaxy?
They appear to be at the center of every galaxy above some mass. You know, maybe maybe the little fragments of galaxies don't all have them. And they had to grow over the last few, 10 billion years plus. So during, you know, as the stars are forming in the galaxy around them, there's also material, protons, electrons, particles like that, falling into the black hole and increasing its mass. And gravity is actually not that strong a force, in fact, but it has a long time to be acting. So, you know, over billions of years, you can accumulate a lot of material into those black holes.
Mm-hmm. And so when they're at the center of the galaxy, we certainly cannot see them, because I'm assuming they're obstructed by dust and other material like other stars. Mm-hmm. So how do we actually detect these black holes?
Yeah, well, for the people who are, you know, very exacting, the black holes themselves, of course, are black. No light is escaping them. But the regions around them are quite bright because material is falling toward the black hole, pulled in by gravity, and it typically settles into an accretion disk, which those tend to get very, very hot and glow quite brightly, often. They put out as much light as many, many stars or even the whole galaxy in a few cases. So they can be very bright, but it's confined to a tiny region that's we can't even resolve it. To us, it just looks like a point of light at the center of the galaxy. They're rare. It looks as if at any one time, maybe depending on brightness, at the very brightest end, it's far fewer than 1% of all galaxies are active. We say active galaxies. But if you just dial down the luminosity and start it, you know, you sort of go toward larger and larger fractions of galaxies. So it's probably continuous. That is, every galaxy has a black hole, and they're growing at different rates, and most of them just grow at very low rates, and we can't see the light from that.
Okay, so the smaller galaxies would have, I guess, a smaller black hole?
Yes, that's another thing that we've noticed, is that the mass of the black hole in the galaxy seems to be proportional in some way to the mass of the galaxy itself. So smaller galaxies have smaller black holes, bigger galaxies have bigger black holes. Some of that may be just, you know, they're growing at the same time, and so if they have longer to grow, they both are bigger. But there may be more direct connections between that maybe, you know, as you collect more gas that can make stars, you can also put more gas into the black hole.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning particles of carbon, nitrogen, etc.
Yeah, elements, yeah. So these supermassive black holes, certainly they're indirect in terms of when we're looking at them.
Right.
Do we use one particular wavelength to look at them? Do we use multiple wavelengths to look at them? How does that work?
So the accretion disk and the surroundings emit light at a very broad range of wavelengths, from radio waves to infrared to optical to ultraviolet to X-ray to gamma rays. So we can actually see them in different wavelengths. But what you're trying to do is find the ones that are rapidly growing. Mm-hmm. And often, if you look in the infrared or the optical, which are sort of the standard telescopes, you're confused by starlight. So every galaxy emits a lot of starlight, and that's comes out in the optical, at optical and infrared wavelengths. So what we do is we look in the X-ray.
Okay.
X-rays come from the innermost part of the accretion disk. It's the most energetic part. And above a certain threshold, only these black holes are emitting X-rays. So if you look for the luminous ones, they're very easy to find in X-rays.
Okay.
So we try to do multi-wavelength surveys. X-rays plus optical infrared. Optical, typically to get the redshift of the object, which is a measure of its distance. And then infrared also helps us find the bulk of the starlight and also be less subject to the obscuration that you talked of.
Okay, okay. Then if we are trying to look at these galaxies in more than one wavelength, and you mentioned that X-rays are kind of the way to go, would those detections kind of tell you the mass of the black hole? How is that being detected?
Yeah, the mass is hard to determine. For nearby black holes, they're really far away for us, you know, compared to your neighbor's house. But, you know, the closest big galaxy to us is a million light years away. But that's super close in astronomical terms. And we can look at galaxies like that in the local neighborhood and measure essentially the orbits of stars around the black hole. And from those, we can actually measure the mass of the black hole the same way that we measure the mass of the sun from looking at how planets circle it. When you go farther away, you can't really resolve the stars near the black hole. And so you have to use indirect methods. And one of the ways that works really well for these active galaxies, they have a lot of emission line light, that is light in particular atomic transitions. And those lines are broadened by the velocity of the atoms, which are, or, you know, in gas that's orbiting the quite close to the black hole. So it has very high velocities. We're talking about, for, you know, people who like speed records, 10,000 kilometers per second. You know, what's the speed limit in Canada? It's 100 kilometers per hour.
Yeah.
So it's a lot faster. From the width of those lines, those lines represent atoms that are orbiting the black hole. So from the width of the lines, you sort of have a velocity of something that's orbiting the black hole. And so in analogy to the solar system orbits giving you the mass of the sun, you can estimate the mass of the black hole.
Okay, yeah. So that's kind of interesting to know how indirect methods would give you mass for the distant objects,
right,
as well.
Yeah.
So in these distant objects, do you see that the black holes, obviously distant objects meaning further back in time.
Mm-hmm.
So are they any different from the black holes that we see close by?
Oh, that's a really good question. We actually have not been able to map the evolution of black holes very well. We can observe, you know, ensembles of black holes now, today, in the local universe and at in a more distant universe and in a still more distant universe. But exactly understanding which ones are obviously we aren't watching, you know, one of them we can only see when they're over there.
Yeah.
We're not going to see it grow.
Yeah.
That would take several billion years. But we can say there's an ensemble of them there and what do they grow into? And we haven't quite mapped that properly yet. But we can do it in computers, right? We can have computer simulations of the growth of galaxies and accretion onto the black holes at their centers. And we can sort of match the distribution of masses that we see today. And so if that simulation is, the simulation is correct insofar as it produces the right answer,
mm-hmm,
did it get things right along the way? Of course, we can't know until we measure black hole masses in those places. And people are working on that. We have a project to do that using the Keck telescopes in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very hard work. It's very hard work. You spend an entire night maybe on one or two objects trying to measure one or two black hole masses. And of course, we need hundreds of black hole masses to do a proper statistical job.
What would you say are the most essential things that were present in, you know, after X number of years after the Big Bang happened that would create these black holes?
Right. So one of the most important ingredients is dark matter, actually. Dark matter is more a name we give to some kind of matter that we have not yet detected in our hands, in our detectors on Earth. You can touch the table, you can touch the chair, but you can't touch dark matter. It doesn't interact with via any force we know about except gravity. And if there were not dark matter, the universe would look very different. For one thing, galaxies would not have formed because there wouldn't have been enough gravity to pull the stars together into a gravitationally bound thing we call a galaxy. So the first ingredient we need is dark matter. And of course, ordinary matter, which is about 5%, 4% of the total mass energy density of the universe. And there's a new thing, a new ingredient that we didn't ask for, but that we sort of got for free, which is called dark energy. Dark matter creates attractive gravity. Dark energy has a similar name, so sometimes people think they're related, but dark energy is actually a kind of pressure pushing the universe apart, making it expand. So the two, in fact, oppose each other. Dark matter gives us more gravity. Dark energy kind of pushes the universe apart. And dark energy was discovered in 1998 and has been studied ever since. It turns out to be the thing that most of the universe is made of at the present day. It's dark energy.
Mm-hmm.
3/4 of the universe is dark energy. And this is something that was unknown, completely unknown before 1998. So that's kind of an example of how exciting astronomy can be. In any case, those are two big ingredients. And luckily, as I said, the physics is simple. Gravity, especially in the early universe, very weak.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the weakest forces. If you have, two apples sitting on your table, the gravitational force between them is really, really tiny. But if they are charged, for example, the electromagnetic force can be very strong. So charged apples, that's really a made-up thing. So you put these particles in your computer, and fortunately, we know the initial conditions. That's the physics name for what was the starting point. Okay, how was matter distributed in the early universe? And we know that because we can measure it in the microwave radio part of the spectrum, we can see the tiny fluctuations in density that are apparent at the epoch. It's about 400,000 years after the Big Bang. It's the time when the universe had expanded enough, it had cooled enough that charged particles like protons and electrons could combine to make hydrogen. Once the universe was neutral, and it was a very short time over which that occurred, then light could pass to us without being scattered. And so we can actually look back to the point where that light was emitted, the surface it was emitted from. And that's a picture, if you like, a baby picture of the universe, of the mass fluctuations in the early days. So that's the starting point for computer simulations, is this distribution of fluctuations that are seen. If you like, how many dense parts are there and how many less dense parts and by how much. And then you just let gravity, you populate it with a bunch of particles, and you let gravity act. Ideally, you would populate it with atoms, okay? Because at that point, that's what existed, atoms. Mm-hmm. But our computers are not big enough by a whole lot to do that problem. We would need, the particles we use are basically anywhere from thousands to millions of times the mass of the sun, which of course has many, many atoms in it. So yeah. 10 to the, I can't even get the number, 50s and 60s of atoms. So we don't have computers big enough to do the entire physics. So we make scaled adjustments. So you start with particles. You do the biggest volume you can with not great resolution. And then you zoom in to parts that are interesting, like galaxy formation, for example. You can make the resolution in that box better and watch how smaller particles interact to make galaxies. And then you can zoom into the center of the galaxy and look at particles heading toward the black hole. Again, we're not able to resolve a whole galaxy and its black hole. It's just too different in scale. Mm-hmm. So we typically watch what galaxies do in getting matter sort of within a few light years of the black hole. But if you want to see accretion, you need to be within a few light minutes of the black hole. So you have to be much closer. And so we can make separate simulations of what accretion onto a black hole looks like. Mm-hmm. So you can sum up all these different kinds of calculations and come and make a sort of coherent picture.
Mm-hmm. Black hole is, I think, one of the most interesting, I guess, objects in the universe. And when I go into classroom, kids love talking about black holes. They probably get the ideas from Star Trek and stuff to, you know, teleport, etc. Uh-huh. But one thing I want to, you know, ask you, which students generally ask me, what would happen if I were to go into a black hole?
Okay, it matters a whole lot on how big the black hole is. And here's where it's kind of counterintuitive because, you know, normally like big things are scary and little things are who cares. If you go in toward a little black hole, let's say a black hole that has a mass of a few times the mass of our sun. When you're, you know, let's say you stretch your arms out. Okay. So your left arm goes in first and your right arm goes in later. The difference in force on your left hand and your right hand would rip you apart. Going into a small black hole like this, small, okay, it's a few times the mass of the sun, but for me, that's really, really small. If you went into a supermassive black hole, let's say 10 to the 8th, 100 million times the mass of our sun, you wouldn't even notice. The average density of a black hole that is 100 million times the mass of our sun is 1 gram per cc, which is the density of water. Now, that's not to say that that's its density. Of course, mass is not evenly distributed. It's all heading toward the center where it's, of course, is much more dense. But at the outskirts, where the horizon is, where you actually enter the black hole at the Schwarzschild radius, the tidal force, how to say this, because the size of you is minuscule compared to the size of that black hole, you don't feel a different force on one side than the other. So you wouldn't even notice you were going in. Whereas for the smaller black hole, you know, your size is closer to the size of the black hole, and therefore your left side feels a really different force than your right side. And that stretches you. It's like, you know, medieval times when you're on the rack. It's mm-hmm. just like that.
That's very interesting. And I think one of the important reasons why we should be studying them more, because they are so interesting and they are at the center of every galaxy, including ours, and, you know, kind of make a difference to our lives as well by studying them. I think we'll end here. So thank you so much for talking to us today.
Oh, it was so much fun. Thank you.
And hopefully we'll have you back again on the show.
I'd love it. Thank you.
And now for the roundtable discussion.
So, what did you think about the interview?
I thought was very interesting, actually. I thought she had a very interesting background and experience, and her research, of course, is particularly intriguing. And to hear her describe it in such terms was also kind of exciting. I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, I think black holes, it's something that everybody knows about, like whether they're interested in science at all, just through pop culture, but it's something that we maybe don't know as much about. So it was interesting to hear her perspective and fill us in on what black holes really are and how we see them.
Yeah, I love, like loved talking to her about how you actually find them, you know, like you see in one wavelength, you don't see them in the other ones, you just see them very prominently. And it's kind of a fun science to, you know, like looking at images, but then you're also actually figuring out the different processes that are going on and the structures in which the processes are going on. So I thought there was, you know, like gravitational waves and black holes and neutron stars are like in news right now. It was a really, you know, it was a privilege to talk to her and, you know, get her views on black hole and how they actually do the research. So
what did you think about speaking to her actually as a, not as a scientist, but as like a, you know,
in person, she is, she's great. She's known for her, you know, she has been advocating for a long time for gender equality, women in astronomy and physics. And, you know, she has lots of awards behind, you know, backing her up, and she has done a lot of work in outreach, and she was great. We had we had a public lecture when she was here, and you know, there were so many people who were interested in knowing about more about black holes, and she was able to communicate everything from the equations of, you know, gravity to actually talking about the details of black hole very easily. And I think that is something which as a complex research area, which kind of drives people away when you look at Einstein's equations and, you know, all those complex things on the board, people are generally driven away. And she actually did a really good job at, you know, explaining where things are coming from and how you would form a black hole, and how you know, it was all theorized back in early 1900s by Einstein, and she made it simple for people to understand.
Yeah, she makes it accessible. Like when you asked her about what would happen if someone went into the black hole, just it made it very easy to understand what would happen.
Yeah.
I immediately started thinking about like the adage about a frog in the the boiling water. And
yeah. No, I think, you know, like kids, especially young kids these days, and something that I did mention to her was they all love knowing, oh, what would happen if I were to go in a black hole. I don't know if it's like the Star Trek or the movie Interstellar that's to effect here of learning what would happen to me if I were to go in a black hole. But trust me, every other event I do, I get that question. So you know, it's good to know from an expert what they think
exactly
about.
You know exactly what to tell them next yeah time you do an event.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, in general, people use different examples of how to explain it. Like we have the word spaghettification, and then we have, you know, people saying, oh, you are the astronaut who stays, you know, who goes into the black hole, but there is another astronaut who's watching you. And like there are lots of different examples out there, but like, you know, getting to know at each of them, kind of using them based on the age group too, right? Like kids, younger kids would love the idea of spaghettification, right? Rather than imagining a person being pulled apart in yeah terms of an atom. It's like exactly that would be disaster for young kids. But
yeah, exactly.
But for older kids, like, you know, grade 9 and above, like that would make sense to them because they're at an age where they understand. So for younger kids, you know, spaghetti as an example, and then
something they can visualize very easily.
Exactly. So, yeah. And she did a great job at, you know, explaining those things. And that, I think, is one of the good things about, you know, scientists these days. They're actually taking time to, you know, get public to understand what they're doing, why they're doing, and why they're investing money, their tax dollars, into the research that's happening.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration. This episode was produced by Parshuti Patel and John Kissy and featured an interview by co-hosts Parshuti Patel and Dana Beaton. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts John Kissy, Parshuti Patel and Dana Beaton. Our editors were Dana Beaton, Parshuti Patel and John Kissy, and I'm John Kissy. Our theme music was Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation, find out more about Western Worlds, and listen to our past episodes by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds, or checking out iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. On behalf of the entire Western Worlds team, I'd like to thank you for spending this time with us. We hope you'll return in the future for the next episode of Western Worlds.